Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We got a full crowd here to talk political issues today. And boy, this is another one of those days when there's so much to talk about. Plenty of news breaking out of Washington. We're going to get to that a little later in the show. But first, want to talk about some of the issues in Georgia. Joining me, as he does on Mondays and Fridays, the lead political writer for the AJC, Jim Galloway. Column is in the Wednesday and Sunday editions of the paper. A little later, I'm going to ask you about your column for this Sunday.
Okay.
So thank you. You also read him in the Political Insider blog, which is part of Politically Georgia, the new subscription service for people who really want to stay informed on politics. Also joining us today, Dr. Andra Gillespie is back. She's a political science professor at Emory University. Thank you, Andra, for being back with us.
My pleasure.
And Julianne Thompson, Republican consultant, longtime activist in Republican Party politics here, one of the big people in the Georgia Tea Party movement a number of years back when the Tea Party was the Tea Party, Julianne. And joining us from Washington, the Washington reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Tamar Hallerman, coming to us, I think, from the Cox Bureau. Thanks for joining us, Tamar.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Oh, it's okay. It sounds like you're on the phone, yes?
I am.
Okay.
So
okay.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, you're not in the Cox Bureau. I don't want to give the wrong impression to people. So, Tamar, I know you've got a lot going on up there. We're going to talk a little state politics, and I know you're paying attention to that, too, but we'll get into some of the things you have to follow right now in Washington in a few minutes. Jim, I want to start with, we now have, here we are at the end of January, and we now have really basically the first big confrontations in the governor's race on both the Republican and the Democratic sides.
Yeah, 4 months out away from the primary. We've got Casey Cagle and Brian Kemp going at each other, and I guess surrogates of Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams going at each other on the Democratic side.
So let's start with the Republican fight that's going on. As we know, Jim, there's been a movement among some political leaders here to find a way to create a paper trail for our electronic voting systems. The current machines won't do that. You'd have to bring in new machines to do it. And we've talked about that, and we'll probably talk about it again. But what sparked this feud was Casey Cagle the other day told a news organization he supports finding a way to have paper balloting. And that sparked Brian Kemp, who accused Cagle, he's the Secretary of State, oversees elections, and he accused Cagle of being part of a liberal democratic conspiracy to undermine our confidence in our election.
And I think as he is wont to do, he invoked the name of Stacey Abrams. Brian Kemp has been trying to cast his candidacy as a contest between himself and Stacey Abrams, which I find very interesting, with all sorts of undertones there. The problem with what he's done here is accusing Cagle of acceding to these liberal conspiracy theories is that when it comes to voting machines and suspicion of what happens to within these data banks, this is a bipartisan issue.
Yeah,
I mean, I would say that most of the pushback that Cox got when she put these machines in, 16 years ago, came from the right. And you're going to have a hot contest, I think, four-candidate contest for Secretary of State right now going on to replace, on the Republican side, to replace Brian Kemp. And to a person, every one of those are casting aspersions at Brian Kemp at the way he's handled voting machines and voting data.
Yeah, but you know, Andra, one of the things that's interesting is, to expand on what Jim is saying, the conversation is bipartisan, and it's a significant conversation. And it appears now that Brian Kemp in his attempt to attack his opponent, has put himself in a box if these conversations move forward.
Well, I mean, this, I think, highlights the reason why the Secretary of State's office should not be a partisan office. I mean, and this is exactly why. And he's in a really weird position because until he resigns, he's overseeing elections. And that's an inherent conflict of interest given what his obvious aspirations are at this particular point. So there's that optical problem there. And then there is that, so how do we deal with the technical issues that arise out of this? So in preparation for this morning, I went back and looked at work that my friend, Charles Stewart, who's a professor at MIT, does on the integrity of voting machines and work that other people have done. One of the things that's actually interesting is that moving to the machines that we have now actually reduced the percentage of lost ballots. So actually, our integrity has improved as a result of having electronic voting systems. But based on the things that I looked at by that comments that he and other people who focus on this type of work have suggested, they don't mind having verification systems. Sometimes they question whether or not they should be paper, but they're generally not opposed to having some type of backup system, if only to give people peace of mind.
Julianne, Jim says it's a bipartisan issue.
It absolutely is. I agree 100%. I mean, they're both running in a highly competitive and what will be a very contentious primary, obviously. Brian Kemp, it's apparent that he feels his integrity is being attacked by Cagle's statement on this. And so he's fighting back in the way that he feels will play to the base. By invoking the names of the Democrats. However, Jim is correct. This is a very nonpartisan issue, and questioning of ballot security hasn't just come from the left. It's come from the right as well, and I don't believe that anyone feels that backup initiatives for ballot security and ballot integrity are a bad idea.
Tamar, you wrote on this. Julianne Thompson says that Brian Kemp was obviously offended by what Casey Cagle said. Do you imagine he was really offended, or he really saw this as part of the battle? He's engaging in a battle to try to undermine Casey Cagle in some way.
It's probably a little bit of both. Excuse me. I mean, we haven't seen them tangled too, you know, so much yet. They've been kind of dancing around each other, and this was an opportunity. But sure, he's been doing this job for years, and if somebody says, you know, the solution you picked is wrong, I could see him wanting to protect his own reputation.
Yeah.
The AJC had an event with House Speaker David Ralston last night, and I asked him about voting machines. And what he said was, number one, there's a House bill that Scott Turner and Scott Holcomb in the House have. They're one's Republican, one's Democrat, on replacing voting machines. Ralston said he really doesn't like that bill because it would push the state back to kind of an opti-scan kind of system where you're using pencils to fill in blanks and such. He doesn't like that. But he did say that he thinks that we need a new system before the 2020 presidential race.
So, Andra, I'm interested in what you just said about the research you did, which shows that we have lost fewer ballots since Kathy Cox was Secretary of State when we went to the system we're using today. But not having a paper trail, does it in fact raise legitimate questions as to whether the counts coming off those machines could be viewed as not being accurate if you don't have some way to look at something on paper? Or is that a misguided notion?
So I think what I would argue is that that's probably more of a political question than it actually is, than it actually is an empirical question. And I think sort of the response that the computer scientists, because I don't do this work, but that the computer scientists and the people who are studying it in this way would argue is that there are other things that don't necessarily involve paper. And I think what people are thinking is that paper is kind of 100% foolproof, and nothing is going to be sort of an 100% fail-safe type of method. And I think I think it's important to keep in mind that, especially the work that Stewart was doing 10 years ago, was that when people were doing the old methods, they still had failure, which is what people sometimes want to go back to. And it's not like those were perfect. In fact, those were probably worse.
Jim Galloway and I, as you said, that looked at each other, and the words that I know didn't have to be said were hanging chads.
No. I was going to say
really
Telfair County, the biggest voting scandal in the history of Georgia politics was, I think, in 1946, Telfair County, where the dead lined up and voted in alphabetical order. Right. That was all on paper ballots.
That's right. Who'd they vote for, Jim?
I believe Gene Talmadge won that
Gene
one.
Gene Talmadge.
I mean, and I think the interesting thing to kind of think about was that just reading in some of the comments that Charles Stewart made, who I should plug as an Emory undergrad, is the fact that he says that the horizon or the frontier for voter fraud is actually in the realm of absentee ballots. So people are focusing a lot on sort of election day issues, but really the place that you can manipulate stuff is via absentee ballots.
Yeah. Okay. Well, obviously it's the first salvo in what promises to be a heated battle. And there are going to be other issues that Cagle and Kemp will be able to clash on even as the legislative session unfolds. Let's talk about the Democratic side of this thing. Abrams and Evans. Jim, do you want to explain what the issue is there?
Well, it's a little bit foggy, but apparently there was an internet ad that the Evans campaign
Instagram.
Get
with it, old man.
all right. Okay. On these tubes, there was a video. There was a video here. All right. And apparently there was some footage of Evans in the in Ebenezer Church and at the MLK. Memorial ceremonies from earlier this month, and the same ad. She's running on hope on the scholarship, but it has all sorts of wordplay there. And her face dissolves into the face of MLK.
Yeah, at the very end, there's a shot of her in the celebration of King Day, clapping in slow motion. There's a fade out, and the poster of MLK comes up. And they pulled it down quickly, Andra. They really got rid of it.
It's not gone. You can find it on YouTube.
Okay. Well, but put it this way. The Evans people took it off of Instagram. And, yes, that's their bad luck. They can't get rid of it entirely. And the criticism has been that, among other things, was she comparing herself to King? Is it cultural appropriation? There is some criticism based on the fact that she has no diversity on her own team, is what the suggestion is. Where do we go with this?
Well, I mean, I have to admit, I am very, very sympathetic to the critique for a number of reasons. One, I think you do have to be very careful about trying to compare oneself to Martin Luther King. That's a really difficult thing to do, and especially to do so without the support of the family. There was the issue of that was kind of a guerrilla videotaping that was done without the consent. Probably the King family, who hasn't said anything, but definitely without the permission of Ebenezer Baptist Church, who has come out very quickly to say so, because the Johnson Amendment is still in effect, and they don't want to jeopardize their tax status in particular by doing that. And I have to say, one, I take it a little personally, because I can find myself in that video, because when I saw one particular shot, I went back to it and paused it and went, I knew I was in that guy's line of sight. And I'm like, oh, that was interesting. Like, you know, I didn't expect to kind of, you know, be in an ad that day. There was just all this kind of stuff where she's trying to show her affinity for African-American people and try to show that, you know, she's down with civil rights, but yet she's taking all of these steps and stepping on toes. And then I think that comes across in a very, very tone-deaf, very, very tone-deaf kind of fashion. And the other thing that was so funny in terms of her going in, just as an aside, because I went through the same door on Monday, was, you know, she shows her going into Ebenezer. She wasn't going through the front door. She was going through the VIP exit on the entrance on the side. It was like I was just watching everything going wrong on so many levels.
In the time that you've been speaking, I called it up and I watched it.
Oh, there you go.
And it was, I do know YouTube. I may not know Instagram, but I know YouTube. This is going to get we're in a territory between now and April 4th, I think, the 50th anniversary of the assassination. This is going to be a very sensitive time for the use of racial imagery, I think, especially on Stacey Evans' part, just simply because of the racial dynamic that this primary race for governor has.
Tamar, it also reminds us that, I mean, nobody really wants this to happen, but when you have a white female candidate, or if you have a white candidate, period, running against African-American candidate in this charged environment, race is going to probably, this won't be the only time that race plays a role. You know, if, okay, so let me ask you, Tamar, What if it was a white leader who she superimposed her image with? It might have been offensive to some people that she might have compared herself to some icon. If it was John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, some people would have said, who is she to compare herself to those iconic leaders? But Tamar, it just happens that she's the white candidate against an African-American candidate, and it adds that racial element, which is something I think could be very difficult down the road. Yes?
Especially because she's, you know, Stacey Abrams, her opponent, is, you know, she's running to be the nation's first black female governor. Yeah. So there's a historic, you know, aspect to this race. And so it makes it, you know, Stacey Evans has got to be really careful about how she maneuvers. And one of the, you know, the time where I think this issue was kind of at the forefront the most was at the Netroots conference in Atlanta last year when Evans came up to speak and a lot of activists came and shouted her down or were holding signs that said, listen to black women. So it's already an awkward dynamic that's starting to play out, and I'm sure we'll see more of it.
I mean, I think to answer your question, it would have been tacky and I think not appropriate for her to superimpose her face onto John F. Kennedy or Eleanor Roosevelt or Hillary
right.
Clinton. It's very presumptuous, and I think that that's off-putting from a messaging standpoint. But I think what is even more troubling about this is just the notion of cultural appropriation.
Right.
And that's the part that you have to be sensitive to. And so when people point out this ad and they critique it, or they point out that she doesn't have a lot of African-American advisors, what it's showing is that she may not have the type of cultural fluency to reach out to an important base that's going to be such an important part of the Democratic electorate in this primary.
Julianne, before we move on, you want to weigh in on this? Or would
sure.
you just as soon as a Republican sit and watch it all unfold?
Well, that, but also, I saw the ad. I was surprised. I think she definitely needs a new messaging consultant. But, you know, she's long been considered the most centrist of the two candidates. And so I was really surprised that she would take a risk like this, being that she is considered by a lot of people to be the more viable of the two candidates in the general election.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Let's move on. Let's take a break right now. When we come back, Jim Galloway referred to it. He had a session last night as part of Politically Georgia. Subscribers got to go, in which he interviewed Speaker Ralston. And some interesting things came out of that conversation. We'll talk about them when we come back from this break. You're listening to Political Rewind.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. We're in the middle of a conversation here, and you might as well just join in. Andra Gillespie, Julianne Thompson, Tamar Hallerman in Washington, and Jim Galloway here in the studio. Jim, why don't you give us a couple of headlines about that came out of your conversation with Ralston last night. You want to pick the one to start with?
Well, I guess the one that I would pick to start with was that, you know, back in December, there was that House Rural Economic Development Council, and they put up a few ideas of how to rescue rural Georgia. It's the rapidly depopulating issues. And one of the ideas was to actually pay people to live there, you know, through tax rebates and such. And the speaker pretty much shot that down. You know, he says basically, what are you going to do? What do you say to people who have lived there their whole lives and never got that?
You called
tax
them
break?
Pioneers.
That was my phrase.
All
it was
right.
you're trying to encourage pioneers. Kind of like it's like an Oklahoma Sooner thing. You know, you're trying to get them out into this empty land here. The other part is that he said that this talk in the state Senate circling around Burt Jones of Jackson, another GOP effort to try to take over the Atlanta airport, not going to happen.
And this is not. We talked about this in some depth on our show on Wednesday. It's certainly not the first time that Republicans, Julianne, have tried to have oversight over the Atlanta airport. They never get very far. And You know, so the question is, why now? And the answer seems to be that Burt Jones is looking at the scandal that's unfolded in the city purchasing department, and this is an opportunity to get in there and say the city isn't capable of dealing with the airport in the best way possible.
Well, I think that that's one aspect of it, but I think that there are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that will agree that because of the busyness of the airport and with all the industry that's coming into Atlanta, we really do need to look at having a second airport, a second metropolitan airport.
Yeah, but that's not a question. Is that a question? All right, so interesting that you brought that up, because I assume that has less to do with whether the city or the state runs the airport and more to do with the fact that Delta is going to fight any second airport, no matter who's in charge.
Of course they are.
There we go.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
Tomorrow, one of the things about this is, why mess with success? I mean, yes, the vending deals at the airport, the concession deals are significant, and they've had oversight and some problems. But Atlanta Jackson Hartsfield is the busiest airport in the world. The customer experience there seems to be pretty good. So the question is, why is this the time to mess with that?
Exactly. And one question maybe Jim knows a little bit more about this is whether this dovetails at all with the power outage at the airport earlier this year, whether that.
And actually, I will tell you what, I think that has more to do with it than what's happening in City Hall, because the City Hall corruption probe really hasn't touched the airport yet. I'm not saying it will or won't, but it doesn't. It focuses on snow removal and all, and some other more mundane areas. But the speaker yesterday acknowledged that was a very disturbing incident. When the whole airport was shut down because the backup system was placed too close to the primary system.
Well, and I guess the question that I would have from that in is that a management problem? Because it seems to be that was a construction management problem.
Yeah, a Georgia Power problem.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I'm not sure that I would blame the airport authority for that situation. It's just a question of who approved the original kind of construction plans and thought that it was smart to put the redundancy in the same place.
Andre, one of the other things that the speaker talked to Galloway about last night was Medicaid. He said, we're not going to expand Medicaid this session or anytime soon, for that matter. And here again, the state misses an opportunity to take advantage of federal money under ACA to cover more people.
Well, I mean, that in and of itself isn't a surprise. So we know that there are people who, if they can't get rid of the ACA entirely, just want to, you know, make sure that they deny as many resources to it as possible to kill it at the vine. I think the bigger question that's going to come from this, though, is if there's going to be a tax windfall because people's adjusted gross income is higher because there are fewer things that they can deduct. Does that then end up translating into sort of the surplus going towards some type of healthcare?
And you know, that's a very interesting question. Yesterday, the speaker said they're going to kind of let this play out a little bit because a lot of this is based on human behavior. We don't know how people are going to file their taxes in April. See what the balance is come January of next year. But, you know, you're talking about $5 billion, and that's not chump change.
Right, but, Julianne, with elections coming up at the end of the year, in May, where some Republicans are probably going to face primary opposition, is holding the line against Medicaid expansion crucial to the Republican conservative base?
I think that the Republican conservative base does not want to expand Medicaid.
Yeah.
Here in Georgia, most definitely. And I think that, you know, there's a variety of issues that they're talking about that Republicans are talking about on the local levels. Of course, you have the rural issues with health care. You have so many conservative Republicans that are in support of certificate of need reform. There's just so many things that are going on right now. I don't expect that we're going to get significant reform of any kind this year because of the elections.
So. All right. So we will watch and see. This, you know, it occurs to me tomorrow that this is certainly something that if you're running as a Democrat for governor, you're going to want to be talking up in a big way as the campaign moves forward. We need to break the logjam against expanding Medicaid.
Yeah, and there seemed to be, you know, for a hot second after, you know, the repeal effort in Congress collapsed, it seemed like there was kind of a glimmer of maybe something will change, or maybe something having to do with waivers, state could seek some sort of waiver to get more money. And it looks like the wind kind of got taken out of that sail pretty quickly.
Well, it may be one of those things that you kind of talk around, especially on the Republican side, you talk around and...
Well, the Republicans,
kind of, yes. Yeah, so you kind of dodge around, and then maybe if you get into office, you do it.
Well, that's right, Julianne. It appeared for a moment that we were going to have, we had a governor, a Republican governor, Nathan Dale, talking about maybe it's time to do this. You had Republican leaders downtown starting to, and then all of a sudden the brakes came on. I think after Trump was elected president is where I would mark the change in that. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I think you have Nathan Deal, who is getting ready to go out of office, and then you have all of the Republican candidates that are running in the primary. So I don't expect the two to mesh well together on their messaging. I think that Nathan Deal certainly has a different way of doing things than, say, Casey Cagle or Brian Kemp would, at least right now, because right, like Jim said, they're running in a primary.
Andrew, you get the last word on this before we move on.
Well, I mean, I don't think it would be surprising if in 2016 you anticipated Hillary Clinton was going to win, that you thought, well, the ACA is not going away, so you might as well go along to get along. And so I think that that's the turning point change of that year.
All right. Let's turn, if we can, to national politics. Tamar, you're certainly busy up there right now. The White House, in the inimitable Donald Trump fashion, he made what appeared to be a somewhat offhand comment the other day, in which he suddenly endorsed the idea of allowing maybe as many as 1.8 million undocumented residents to go get a path for citizenship, apparently something that would play out over 10 years. We're going to see the plan in more specifics, we're told, on Monday. I think that many people's jaws dropped and wondered if this was President Trump just saying something that wasn't going to go anywhere. But the White House has followed up and said, absolutely, and they have a proposal for what they want in return for that. Right, Tamar?
Exactly. We started seeing some details last night during a White House call with the media, and the numbers was really surprising to me. Only about 700,000 young people brought to the country illegally as children are part of the DACA program, which Trump wants to cancel. But all of a sudden, they came out with this number, 1.8 million, significantly larger than 700,000. And I believe that also encapsulates all the children who would have been eligible for DACA
but didn't apply for it.
But in exchange for that, they want $25 billion in a trust fund to build the border wall. They want enhanced deportations, ending chain migration, an issue that David Perdue talks a lot. And they also want to get rid of this diversity lottery that's been around for more than 20 years. So it's been kicking up a lot of debate already.
Yeah, so now, let's take a look.
Democrats are not happy.
Let's take a look at that from both points of view. Julianne, immediately Breitbart pushed back, called him Amnesty Don or whatever the exact language was. Once again, talking about the conservative base, this isn't going to make people happy who are a part of that Trump base, right?
Well, it hasn't made them happy.
Yeah.
All you have to do is look at social media to see that. And Ted Cruz actually came out with statements against it, saying that he's breaking campaign promises and this is the absolute worst thing that he could be doing, caving on amnesty. So I this isn't going over well with the base at all.
On the other hand, Andre, it helped me with this because he puts the Democrats – it's a cagey move in some ways – because the Democrats have been at hollering, saying we need DACA. These young people deserve to be protected. And now he says, well, we'll protect a million more. But in return, he's demanding wiping out virtually all of the things that we think about when we think about our immigration system. So to some extent, it's a poison pill. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Democrats should have been able to see from a mile away that the compromise was going to fundamentally come down to DACA protection for the wall. And so then it becomes a question of, well, what else could you get from this? And so I think Democrats thought that they were had some leverage as a result of the S-hole comments. And that's been proving really hard to materialize. And so it becomes a question of, from there, what else can you get? And then I think it becomes a question on the other side, since there are people who are to the right of President Trump on this particular issue who are also not satisfied, like, where does he end up pivoting to more so than anything
but,
else?
But, yeah, go ahead, yeah. Jim.
I'm going to disagree with that.
Okay.
On one side is DACA. I think the wall has become incidental. I think Democrats were very, very willing to see the wall as, you know, as a poor symbol, but as ultimately a money pit. I think the real bargain here is DACA for a halving of immigration into the U.S. and a very, very and a shift from chain migration, which has been U.S. policy since 1965, I believe, to one more merit-based.
And looking at Chuck Schumer's statement today in response to Trump's initial offer, that's what he was focusing on. He was making it seem like it was a heartless change to the way that we've done business on immigration for a long time, you know, keeping families separate. I believe he didn't even mention the wall.
Well, so, I mean, I take those points, but I think for a lot of people who are on the far left, they see any type of compromise and that symbol as actually being important as well. They care about sort of the notion of family reunification, and they're looking at that as being contradictory. But I think sort of some of the issues that you're going to see people on the left bring up are, one, who's paying for it? And then, two, you said you were not going to support this at all costs, so why are you compromising on this? And I think that there is less of a will to compromise, which is going to make it difficult for all sides to be able to negotiate on this.
And I think we're using, you know, the word wall over and over again because that is what he promised in his campaign, and that Mexico was going to pay for it. But I think what Republicans are most concerned about is the enhanced border security, the ending of chain migration and merit-based immigration. So I think those particular facts, like Jim mentioned a few minutes ago, those are probably the most important things to Republicans. With the wall there because it was promised.
And I think it's very interesting the way that our concept of chain migration has changed really rapidly in the last. I mean, it's become a bad word in political lexicon. I mean, basically, what this is, it's the way that immigration has always worked in the United States. You have somebody take the chance, move across the pond. They write a letter home saying there are jobs here. Why don't you have Brother John or Uncle Joe come on over? That's always been the way it is. And in 65, what happened was the U.S. said, yeah, let's put this into law because if you have family-based immigration, that's an immediate support system for these people coming into the country, and the government won't have to pick up the bill.
Okay, but before we move on from this, I do want to make a point. Tomorrow is, Trump does want $25 billion, apparently, in the proposal, eventually, to build the wall. So it isn't as if, I understand that there are other issues that have risen in prominence, but he wants a lot of money to build this wall. And Tamar, the reality is, if you're talking about a president who, on the first day of his campaign, disparaged Mexicans, and has done that consistently. And so there is a way in which any effort to continue funding for a wall continues this sense of people who are opponents of his that this is the symbol of his bigotry and he's still pushing for it. Does that make sense at all? For opponents I'm talking about now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it just goes to show how radioactive this issue is.
Yeah.
Every single part of this proposal is controversial for its own set of reasons. And you know, as the days go on, I wonder if there's any sort of agreement that could be struck or if perhaps he ends up pushing back the deadline for when, initially he wanted the program to end on March 5th. I wonder if he delays that. The president mentioned doing that a few weeks ago.
And
maybe things are just too difficult. Yeah.
Tamar, we've heard from Ted Cruz saying that this isn't good. So there's a possibility of a filibuster or something like it on the Senate side. Have we heard anybody from the House Freedom Caucus on this, because I think that's the other hurdle that this thing's going to have to pass.
Exactly, and I believe we did see something from the chairman, Mark Meadows, complaining that this was amnesty. One fan of this proposal who very quickly made his support known was David Perdue, though. He's been championing a lot of these issues as well, especially the chain migration and the diversity visa.
He has never endorsed citizenship.
I thought that was fascinating.
Exactly. But this is his ally in the White House. I mean, the president has supported his proposal on immigration. So I would have been surprised if David Perdue abandoned it.
Yeah, but this is why it's so tricky, isn't it, Andra? I mean, here's David Perdue, who's been one of Trump's best friends in Washington, certainly has never endorsed a path to citizenship, wants the president to continue to support his own immigration plan, but maybe at the cost of losing people in the base who are saying, wait a minute, we sent you to Washington because we thought you were going to shut down immigration.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, and he might be looking at this like a business person. And so basically by allowing DACA recipients to stay in the United States, that's pretty much sunk cost. They're already here. They live here, they're acculturated here, this is their home. And so it doesn't make sense to send them home. But if he does that and he gets everything that he wanted in the RAISE Act that he and Tom Cotton have proposed, then that ends up being a win-win. And so for whatever the motivations behind it, and I'm not too keen about what I think might be motivating that stuff, but if he gets the end to chain migration that he wants, if he gets sort of his notion of what meritorious sort of entry into the United States looks like, then this is a win for him. And then nobody has to get sent home to some place that they never knew.
But Julianne, if he gets all that and yet says, yeah, we'll be glad to find a path to citizenship, does he guarantee himself a challenge from the right in his next election campaign?
I don't know. I mean, I think that Andra brings up some very good points, and I think that the things that she said are the things that most Republicans are concerned about the most. However, he did make this campaign promise. I mean, and it was the first thing that he said at every rally and the last thing that he said at every rally. It was a huge, huge issue for him, and the reason that he got so many swing votes because of the way that a lot of people felt about immigration, illegal immigration. And so I think that he is he's kind of between a rock and a hard place here. This is about the fact now that don't make promises that you can't keep. And certainly, you know, somebody that was so vocal about a wall started out by changing what a wall means. It no longer means a physical wall. Now it's a virtual wall in some places. Now it's landscape terrain in other places. He's changed so much and evolved so much on what this wall actually means that I'm not going to be surprised if the wall actually goes away.
I love it when we describe politicians not as flip-flopping, but evolving.
Well, actually, Julianne brings up a really good point. I mean, yes, the White House is going to put out a sheet of paper next week. The question is, Donald Trump remains the guy who's going to cut the deal.
Yeah.
And can Donald Trump be trusted to hold his position?
Perfect segue, Mr. Galloway, because I believe that gives me the opportunity to say that is a story that's going to be really interesting to follow in the weeks ahead on Political Rewind. But right now we've got to get in our final break of the show. So let's do that. And when we come back, let's talk about this explosive report from the New York Times last night about President Trump's apparent intention, reported intention, to fire Robert Mueller last summer. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
The jellyfish is already one of the world's most feared creatures, and now there is worry it is taking over the oceans. Or is it? I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, the untold story of the jellyfish and some fascinating facts that may even make you like them. Plus, what do snowflakes, diamonds, and chocolate have in common? Want to know? Well, you can find out on the next Science Friday from PRI.
Today at 3 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. The AJC's Tamar Hallerman joins us from the Washington Bureau of the AJC. Jim Galloway, of course, is with us. Dr. Andra Gillespie, Julianne Thompson. Tamar, last night, the New York Times broke a story that immediately caused a firestorm. They report through several sources that the president called in his attorney, Don McGahn, and asked him to go to justice and tell them they needed to fire Robert Mueller as special counsel. McGahn, according to the New York Times reporting, pushed back and said he wouldn't do it, that he'd resign rather than do that, and presented an argument to Trump for why it would be an incredibly dangerous and stupid thing for the president to do. So, Tamar, what's the atmosphere like on the Hill up there as a result of this story?
I mean, I was in the Senate when in the press gallery when this story came out, and everybody, you know, was just gasped. I mean, hearing it. I mean, this is a bombshell, and this comes at a critical moment for the special counsel's investigation, because you're watching Mueller get closer and closer to Trump. He's, you know, we know now that he wants to interview the president. The president seems like he's agreed to it and is willing to do it. And you know, how close can he get on calling him for obstruction of justice? This story probably does not help the president's case.
Andra?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that's actually really important about it is that it's another piece of evidence. And I think you have to take the long approach to figuring out how this case is going to completely transpire. So I think everybody is looking for the smoking gun.
Yeah.
Or I think everybody is probably looking for, you know, some literal sort of like habeas corpus, like, so, you know, like a foot sticking out somewhere so you can be, aha, it's there. And this is not how this case is going to eventually be resolved. And so this is one additional kind of data point, one additional piece of evidence that looks in there. And I think the question that legal scholars are going to ask is, just because you thought it, if you didn't actually do it, does it then constitute actually like credible evidence?
Yeah, great. And then if you
ordered somebody to contact the DOJ, does that order count as something? I will tell you, Bill, that what fascinated me most about the story were the excuses that were concocted to justify this, including the fact that Robert Mueller quit a Trump golf course because
the greens fees were too high. There were three: that the Trump golf course. The second was that Mueller had worked for the law firm that represented members of the Trump family. And the third was that the president, we are learning from the New York Times article, literally the day before Mueller was named special prosecutor, apparently interviewed Mueller for the job of FBI director. These are the rationale that the New York Times reports were used on this. Julianne, what's interesting about this, of course, the president calls this another fake New York Times story. What's interesting, though, is that the Times reporting on those three excuses lines up directly with quotes from other White House officials months ago about why Robert Mueller should be removed from the job. So it does make you wonder if, despite his calls of fake news, whether this isn't an accurate story.
Well, I wouldn't be entirely shocked to learn that he wanted Robert Mueller fired. That's not a big shocker. But I think that there's, you know, probably a variety of other reasons other than the ones that were just written about, which I think we're going to talk about later when we talk about the memo. But but I think that there's a lot of things that go into it. Whether or not it happened, I don't know. Trump says it didn't. Sources say it did. So I'm not sure we'll ever know.
All right. Tamar, Julianne just mentioned the other things going on, and this has been an increasingly contentious and disturbing scenario to watch play out. We now have a number of Republicans on the Hill who are painting a picture of the investigators at FBI and DOJ as corrupt, partisan, and out to get the president of the United States. And, of course, they began their basis for this initially was the text messages between two FBI agents who were assigned to the investigation, who clearly had anti-Trump messages going back and forth. When that was revealed, they were immediately let go by Mueller. But that certainly started the ball rolling on this, right?
Exactly. And in one of these leaked texts between the two agents, one of them had mentioned the word secret society. And nobody quite knows what that means, if that was a joke, if that was for real. but it's definitely ignited a ton of rumors on the Hill.
Yeah, let's listen.
I'm
sorry to interrupt you. Let's listen to Senator Ron Johnson, who was the first one from Wisconsin, who was the first one to mention the phrase secret society.
We have an informant that's talking about a group that were holding secret meetings off-site. There's so much smoke here. There's so much suspicion.
Let's stop there. A secret society, a secret meetings off-site of the Justice Department.
Correct.
And you have an informant saying that.
Yes.
Tomorrow, Ron Johnson has backtracked. He's tried to back away from those comments. But the notion that there are people on the Hill talking about a secret society within our law enforcement community is troubling. Yes.
I mean, it's interesting. And also, you know, there's such pressure on the right to release this memo. And a lot of House Republicans, including many from Georgia, are agitating to release it. What's interesting is that members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, including the Republican chairman, have yet to see it. Trump's own Justice Department is begging them not to release these memos. So we could see a vote in the next week to do that. One interesting tidbit, I was talking to two Republican members of Congress from North Georgia in very conservative districts. And what surprised me is they said they got more phone calls about this issue, constituents wanting to release this memo, than they did about the government shutdown.
Let's explain that the memo, separate from the texts, is something in the hands of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes,
right,
who has been a big advocate of Trump throughout all of this. Is about to release a memo which allegedly has information about this plot, if that's the word to use.
A deep state plot?
A deep state plot. And there's all sorts of controversy around that because Nunes has never seen the underlying material that led to the creation of this memo. But, you know, this gets more and more intricate, and we are not going to go into the depths of it, Andra, but we now have a number of individuals on the Hill, mostly Republicans, who are actually raising issues about the credibility of our law enforcement community.
And that's troubling just from a sort of institution's perspective and whether or not you're actually instilling trust in institutions by doing this and are you undermining this. I mean, I think it's actually really important. I think sort of, you know, basic rules of evidence apply here. Don't write reports on innuendo. In these types of situations, you want primary sources. You know, you don't want to rely on secondary sources too much about these types of things. And you need context for things. And there was this unhappy coincidence of certain text messages disappearing. They've now been recovered, and so people are looking at them. And so the context, perhaps, of the secret society was that, as a joke, when these agents thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win, they were going to send out sort of posters of Vladimir Putin, and that was their secret society. And so while I think it's inappropriate for FBI agents to be using their government phones to be sending text messages about their personal political opinions, they have a right to not be politically naive. They have a right to their own opinions, and we need to trust and hold them to a standard where they are being objective and professional
and
doing their work.
Julianne, this is one of those issues where it depends on what cable news channel you tend to watch. And I want to play for you sound from Sean Hannity the other night in which he framed what this is all about and then get your response.
Also tonight, the walls are closing in on those responsible for this massive corruption, abuse of power at the top levels of government in what we are now calling state-sponsored sabotage. Now, with this flood of damning news exposing all this malfeasance, the special counsel Robert Mueller and his spokespeople in the media are now working overtime. They want to create as many distractions as possible and discredit anybody that's telling the truth, like us here on the Fox News Channel, for daring to report on the truth.
So, Julianne, that's kind of a mind-blowing statement, including Hannity is accusing Robert Mueller of being part of the conspiracy to undermine Trump. What do you think when you hear that?
Well, I think no matter what side of the political aisle that you're on, you can find a network that will be an echo chamber for you and will say what you want to hear. And both sides are accusing the other of cover-ups. So,
okay, but in this case, you have the most popular personality on Fox News accusing the intelligence community of trying to undermine the authority of the White House, and that Robert Mueller is a part of that. That seems to me to go beyond the usual echo chamber kind of rhetoric, doesn't it?
Well, I think that one of the things that you have to look at is that Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, the two that were sending these text messages to each other, Peter Strzok is one of the people that led the Clinton email investigation. So, of course, he is under extra scrutiny. And I'm looking at one of the text messages between the two where Lisa Page tells him, and this was on CBS News this morning, because as Andra said, suddenly after the threat of releasing this memo, 10,000 text messages, 5 months' worth of text messages have now been found, even though we were told that they could not be found. She says, you might want to go easy. She might be our next president. The last thing you need is going in full loaded for the bear. And he said, agreed. So, I mean, that's just kind of a little window into that. And then you add to that, you know, you have FBI agent Andrew McCabe, who also, along with Peter Strzok, led the Clinton email investigation. His wife received over $675,000 from Terry McAuliffe, who was the chairman of Hillary Clinton's campaign. So to question the ethics of some, not all, but some FBI agents, I think, is warranted.
Jim, we're running out of time.
Okay. All I would say is this makes it's going to make what happens on the other side of Robert Mueller's report very, very interesting.
Yeah. That's, Andra, what strikes me is that this, again, we are setting up a situation in which truth and an effort to find truth, no matter who's looking for it, it's going to have very little to do with what happens afterward.
I understand that, and you know, and I fully accept that as a political animal, but as a teacher, there are certain basic rules about like evidence and what in context that I think, you know, it should apply to everybody. And, you know, I wish that, you know, people would just remember those things that they learned in school or seek to learn them out now so that we can all be sort of looking at the same data and then having standard common rules
all
about
right.
how to interpret
Andra
it.
Andra Gillespie, you get the last word on today's show. We're completely out of time. Tomorrow, Hallerman, Jim Galloway, Julianne Thompson, Andra Gillespie, thank you all for being here. Jim, we have enough time to tell people that on Sunday you have a column that may surprise a lot of people. It has to do with...
What if the Eugene Talmadge Memorial Bridge in Savannah isn't the Eugene Talmadge Memorial Bridge?
The bridge whose name is under question and review right now because some people in Savannah don't think it should be named after a Georgia politician who is famous for being a segregationist. And so there's been many attempts to change the name. Galloway, you're going to tell us why maybe the name was never real in the first place.
We'll talk about it on Monday.
All right. That's it for us for today. You'll read that in his Sunday column in the AJC. Thank you to Olivia Rheingold and Tom Faust for your work on the show again today. We'll see you again. I hope you have a great weekend.